and welcome to our podcast. My name is Robert Payne. I'm a principal consultant with Perspectus, and I've been with the organization now for over 18 years. Perspectus has been a leading charity sector recruiter now for over 60 years and recruits at all levels, from CEOs to head of departments, from directors, managers, officers and coordinators to specialist disciplines such as HR, communications, finance and policy. For the past 10 years or so, I have specialised purely in recruiting to trust foundations and grant-making organisations. We thought it would be a good idea to get together to discuss some of our approaches and learnings over the past few years when it comes to diversity, equity and inclusion. One of the catalysts for this session was a conversation we had with one of our clients when taking a briefing on a key role for their organisation, where they asked very pointedly, how can we work together to make sure that we achieve the most diverse shortlist possible for this role? For years now, we've been striving to make sure that our processes and practices are as equitable and outreaching as possible to people from diverse communities. We've been asked this question many times in various ways by our clients. What we've decided to do here is to answer these questions and to set out some of the practices we've developed internally and some approaches and insight we have learned from our candidates and clients externally, and to share them with you in this podcast. As DEI is such an encompassing and nuanced subject, in order to delve a little deeper into the specific dynamics of various protected characteristics, we've decided to produce a short series of podcasts looking individually at some of the following areas, which are people from Black and minoritized communities, those who experience both physical, mental and neurodiverse disabilities, and finally gender and LGBTQ community issues. This is in order to explore more deeply specific characteristics of each segment, to try to come up with some tailored and useful tips for each. We are more than conscious that there will be connected intersectional components, of course, throughout the series, but we feel this is a useful way to explore the subjects more deeply throughout. In fact, the connected dynamics being repeated will hopefully serve to emphasize their importance. Hi there. Welcome everyone to the second in our series of podcasts on increasing representation of people with disabilities, both visible and invisible, and neurodiversity in our shortlisting processes here at Perspectus. To get things started, I'll let everyone introduce themselves briefly.
Hi, I'm Jess. I'm a recruitment consultant at Perspectus and I am also neurodiverse.
Hi, I'm Zola. I'm part of the senior recruitment team here at Perspectus.
Hi guys, my name's Awais. I'm part of the exec search team at Perspectus.
Hi, I'm Matt Till. I'm associate director here at Perspectus and lead the senior recruitment team.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm the talent exec here at Perspectus. So I do all the internal recruitment and some HR for us.
Thanks, Lauren. So to move forward then, really, the priority for this podcast is to be talking about increasing representation for people with disabilities, both visible and invisible, and neurodiversity in our shortlisting processes. So I suppose one of the first things to start chatting about is accessibility. And by that, I mean how we make our roles accessible to candidates from these communities, both in terms of our advertising and our outreach, I guess. You know, job packs, adverts, where we advertise, what social media platforms we use. I just wondered if any of you have any thoughts initially on accessibility when it comes to candidates with disabilities or from the neurodiverse community. What would be our priorities when it comes to accessibility?
I think formats is really key, showing that the format in which job descriptions, advert text is presented is in an accessible format. So that might be ensuring that it can be read by certain technologies that people with visual impairments can use, or it might be creating different types of job packs where with slightly different color contrasts, making it easier for people to read. So format, I think, is really a key thing for accessibility. And I think it might not be of value to 99% percent of people, but I think it's really important for the people that really do need that to be able to access and engage with the role to be able to do that and hopefully apply.
So making sure that our jobs packs are digestible and tailored towards people who have different ways of learning, different ways of reading things, visibility, etc. So yeah, that's a really good point. Jess?
I think that when you're sort of describing the role, it's better to just be clear and use as much concise information as you can. Like, having such big blocks of text can really be difficult for people to read if it's like an attention thing or if it's a comprehension thing. So just keeping it clear and concise, as if you were going to talk to someone and say, so this is what I want you to do. I would want that in an advert rather than, you know, the really formal way of explaining job descriptions.
Yeah. Because I think job descriptions often by definition can be quite exhausting to read, can't they? I know that a lot of organizations think that they have to put absolutely every bit of information they can on a job description when actually, you know, bullet points, clarity, simplicity, all of those things are really important. And that's a general rule, really, is more pronounced when it comes to people who may have learning or visual difficulties when it comes to reading job descriptions. So that's a really good point. Owais?
I think it's also important to use inclusive language. So, you know, that job ad is inviting for people to encourage them to apply, and also, you know, highlighting what your accessibility statement is and the accommodations you're willing to make for people who've got disabilities or neurodivergent.
Yeah. So people quite quickly can recognize there that the organization is going to be open, welcoming, and supportive to people with different needs, really. Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah, and I think with regards to some of the senior roles that we do, that those, you know, building upon Jess's point there, role descriptions can be quite expansive. They can have a number of different responsibilities that they need someone to cover or have oversight of. I think something I've seen that's been really powerful for candidates is, you know, when you've got those number of requirements, having something where it's very clear, you know, what we expect you to achieve in 3 months, what we expect you to achieve in 6 months, what we expect you to achieve in 12 months. Those things can make it really clear to focus the mind on, these are the things that I'm going to be doing when I first come in. These are the things that I can put to one side, and I'll be looking at addressing them later on down the line. I think it can help provide a little bit of clarity about what exactly candidates will be coming in and doing at the very early stages of that role.
And not trying to include too much more information that isn't necessarily relevant for this particular job, I guess. So again, it's back to brevity, simplicity, clarity, etc. Lauren?
Yeah, just on kind of stripping it back to kind of where people were viewing the job ads. So, for instance, on kind of companies' websites now, the accessibility on websites specifically for neurodiverse people, you're able to kind of dim the colours on the website. And I think that shows from the get-go the company's attitude and potential kind of in-work support to people from the very beginning, specifically for neurodiverse people, but it shows from the very beginning that it's something that's important to them. So I think kind of going right back to the beginning of where the job ads are placed, obviously they're going to be on other job boards as well. But I think the company's website that is one of the first thing that people, you know, go to when they see a job ad. And if that's showing signs that they are inclusive, I think that's also really important for when people are applying for roles initially. Yeah, and it just shows that like a company's commitment to neurodiverse candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a holistic thing, isn't it? So in the job description, if you stick to simplicity and clarity, there will probably be a website link there as well. So if, you know, that's clicked on and they go to the website and there's nothing really that pushes forward the welcoming nature of the organization when it comes to people with disabilities, then you're missing a trick really, isn't it? So it has to be a connected up way of depicting the organization. So yeah, absolutely, everything has to be in line.
I think also we find that a lot with temp recruitment specifically, like clients will send us a full job description for a temp that's only going to be there for 3 months. And there's no way that they're going to be expected to do all of the things because they've got the full-time JD. So I think it's important to outline what your realistic expectations are, especially for people who are neurodiverse and are going to want to know what's expected of them so that they can prepare themselves, especially for interview, to say that I can do X, Y, Z. It's just really important to know what's actually expected, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just concentrating really on only the information that's needed for the role itself, isn't it? Not worrying too much about superfluous information, but just stating exactly what's needed for the role. And again, it's back to that simplicity, isn't it? Thank you. Zola?
I just wanted to highlight the part on the company's commitment. Something that I have noticed recently is that a lot of adults are actually going through testing for neurodiversity. So they haven't actually been diagnosed yet, but they are in the process. And that sometimes does impact them throughout the application. So I would just kind of add, on top of the statement that a company can release, it would also be really good to have a line there that opens conversation to those candidates that they can call or they can actually send an email disclosing where they are in their process, because some people may not feel comfortable disclosing until they actually have that official diagnosis. So just going back to that welcoming environment and letting them know that at any stage of their diagnosis or of their process, that is something that the company is quite open to.
Absolutely. One other thing when it comes to accessibility is obviously physical accessibility. I think if it's office-based work, which there invariably will be, making sure that the offices are accessible for those with physical disabilities and to make sure that they are able to access the building. And again, I suppose that could be included in the statement, couldn't it, with the job descriptions, etc. One thing we'd like to move on to really is the program of Disability Confident that Prospectus is signed up to. I think some of our clients may be aware of it and some people may not. I think if I'm right in thinking that it is a government-funded program and it's been around for quite some time, and I think it's been through some changes. I'm wondering, Lauren, whether you may be able to let us know a little bit about your perceptions of Disability Confident, and then possibly some of the panel can talk about their experiences of it when they've been representing Disability Confident clients to our candidates, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right, it is a government scheme, and it is something that was put in place a couple of years ago to ensure it's kind of a support for companies or businesses that are looking to become more inclusive with their recruitment when it specifically comes to people with disabilities. There's certain commitments and there's a couple of levels that you can go through. We're actually at Prospectus, we're level 2. So we're classed as a disability confident employer, but we're actually working towards level 3, which would mean we become a disability confident leader, hopefully in the next couple of months. But yeah, there are some commitments, and those commitments are having inclusive and accessible recruitment, communicating vacancies. So we spoke a little bit about that, how vacancies can be put on maybe specific job boards that might support people with disabilities into employment. So just kind of thinking about where your vacancies are being advertised. Offering interviews to disabled people. So if people meet the certain minimum requirements for the role, then they are offered guaranteed almost an interview for that position. Providing reasonable adjustments. So obviously that can be from throughout the whole process, starting just pre-screen through interview all the way through to in-work support with companies. So just ensuring that people are asked about reasonable adjustments at every stage. And the fifth commitment is supporting existing employees. So I mentioned earlier about how employers from the get-go that are looking at kind of websites can kind of see how committed to employers are all the way through to actually being employed by that company and the in-work support that might be needed for that specific person. So they're the five commitments that are part of the Disability Confident Scheme. As I mentioned, we're currently level 2. So we are internally recruiting. We guarantee interviews to people with disabilities. I personally see it as a really positive thing. I think that people, anyone, any business, any company, any size can sign up to the scheme. But interested to hear what other people think about the scheme
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for that. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, it does really emphasize how powerful that would be to candidates as a demonstration of organizations' commitment to welcoming candidates with disabilities, wouldn't it? So, you know, that would be a very sort of poignant way of demonstrating to candidates that they will be welcome. So the basis of it is if candidates meet the minimum requirements of a role, then they will be guaranteed an interview. I suppose that's something that's quite important in our shortlisting processes. So if candidates are aware of that, I imagine that would be quite powerful welcome to those candidates.
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to sign up to and commit to. I think it demonstrates externally an organization's commitment to bringing more people in with disability. And I think that's the kind of how it's perceived is really important to try and get more people to apply for roles that are disability. But I sometimes think that it can be a little bit challenging in terms of it not quite being enough. And I think that that extension needs to look at what the interview process looks like itself. And, you know, I think particularly in areas where roles can be very competitive, it might be that you have someone who has a disability, part of the disability confidence scheme gets themselves an interview because they meet the minimum requirements. But then when they go to interview, they're against candidates that meet all of the essential criteria and a majority of the desirable criteria. So I think if you're really committed to wanting to bring people in with disability, maybe having a look at your interview process as well, making sure that it's not really rigid, it's not based on really firm scoring. I think people can be greater than the sum of their parts. And I think making sure that we're looking at the whole piece and ensuring that candidates who are being brought forward to interview through the Disability Confidence Scheme are being brought forward because they really definitely stand the chance rather than them, you know, being set up to fail almost. So I think it's a really powerful scheme. I think it has a lot of potential, but I think, you know, it needs to go a little bit further in looking at the actual interview process as well.
Yeah. So it's a very powerful scheme, but it needs to be backed up by authenticity when it comes to people getting interviews and them having a realistic chance of getting the roles. I suppose that filters into an organization's real commitment to welcoming people with disabilities, I guess. So, you know, from a candidate's perspective, if they get in front of an employer, that is a really good step towards accessibility for them, isn't it? As to whether they're successful or not at that interview is obviously another step, or maybe another debate for another day. But getting them in front of employers does give them the opportunity to be able to state their case for their suitability for the role.
I think as well, there might be a kind of slight nervousness as well for companies to sign up to certain schemes, just in regards to, for instance, I've spoken to some of our consultants before about what is considered as minimum requirements for the role. And I think it comes down to your own decision, well, the client's decision or prospectus decision is what their minimum requirements are. I've had a conversation with a consultant that said, you know, is minimum requirement actually them, you know, is it 70% of the requirements of the role that they have to tick, or is it 20% of the role? And I think sometimes there is a nervousness from businesses to sign up to these schemes when they're not 100% sure how to deal with the schemes and the questions that might come from it. So there could be a position where it's actually to people that have disabilities, if they feel that they're actually going to be disclosing something that's really important to them, but actually it could mean it's used against them further down the recruitment process. So that's really interesting what kind of
That's a really good point. And I think we're going to come on to talk about disclosure, actually, and our thoughts about disclosure. One of the things that hit me in what you were saying, Lauren, really, is that actually it is one of the principles in celebrating EDI, really, is removing barriers to employment. And I suppose as part of the Disability Confident Programme, if it encourages you to get your job descriptions tailored to exactly what's needed for the role, and only what's needed, removing things that are maybe not 100% needed, is a process of removing barriers, isn't it? And again, culturally, hopefully that encourages employers to actually think about the actual structure of their roles to make them more accessible. So yeah, it is a holistic approach, really. And I see Disability Confident as quite a useful tool in that journey, I guess.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, I think there's a need for some businesses to kind of fluff up job descriptions as much as possible and put as much information in them as they can, when actually, from a kind of neurodiverse perspective, neurodiverse people can sometimes take things very literally. So you have to be careful with what is said on some of the job descriptions. I can't actually think of an example off the top of my head right now, but I just think being concise, being to the point on job descriptions, not necessarily, you know, fluffing them up as much as people feel the need, just being straight to the point is actually far more going to attract people that are specifically neurodiverse than making them 3 pages long when they can just be very
short. Absolutely. And maybe even maybe getting some internal training on neurodiversity and how to communicate on paper with people who are neurodiverse. That kind of training can all but sort of lead in the right direction, can't it? The next point we were going to talk about, it actually leads on from that, is that terms and conditions of the role, things like offering job shares, part-time, full-time, hybrid working, etc. Obviously, it is very important to people with disabilities. You know, sometimes they're not able to do a full-time role. Sometimes part-time work works better for them, job shares, etc. Matt, you had a thought on this?
Yeah, I think the terms and conditions of a role being a little bit more flexible for people's needs when they have disabilities or not neurodivergencies is something that I think is really important. And I understand, you know, we're seeing a lot of employers relook at their policies, tighten them up a little bit, make sure that they're fair for everybody or the same for everybody. But I do think there's going to be a little bit more leeway given to candidates with disabilities. You know, I've seen roles. When looking at the data, the equal opportunity data, I've seen roles that are full-time, I've seen jobs that are part-time. The number of candidates that disclose a disability for part-time roles is sometimes tenfold. And I think, is it possible to look at advertising a role as a full-time? And if you need someone full-time, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you can put it out there as a, we're looking for this role to be delivered full-time or via a job share, you know, two people coming forward and being able to deliver that together. And I think that helps a lot as well. You know, if you're looking at things like job shares, the two people that's part of that job share could have different strengths, different experiences. They can learn from one another. And together, they might be able to, or should be able to, fulfill that role full time. So I see massive differences in going out for roles that are part time or have slightly different conditions than a full time position in increasing that representation in shortlists.
Yeah, absolutely. Because obviously two part-time roles in a job share is a full-time role, isn't it? But then again, depicting that in the job description, again, is a way of removing barriers, but also giving candidates the tools they need and the information they need to make a decision on whether to apply, isn't it?
Also, just to add on to that, I think something that's worth exploring is remote working and the doors that it opens to some candidates who may not be able to physically come into the office 2 or 3 times a week. However, when you look at the candidate's experience, when you look at the skills, the expertise that they bring to the role, they are very much capable of performing with this position, but just working remotely. So I definitely do think that's also another area that companies really do need to look at and actually broaden the scope of their candidate pool to.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. And it is a positive byproduct of the pandemic that we all went through and the changing culture that hybrid working is now a very prevalent aspect of normal working life. And what it does do, it is enables organizations to access the skills from people with disabilities who may not be able to leave their home. So I think that's a fantastic point.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, following up from Zola's point, I think all organizations maybe need to look at removing physical barriers, and that is ensuring that their office is accessible. And that could be for people who have disabilities to do with their mobility, or it could be visual impairment, ensuring that it doesn't affect them in a negative way. But also, I think the remote working is great, but I think organizations need to be careful in not excluding them. So that's if you do have remote workers, that they do have interaction with the team and they feel a part of the team. And I've had it before when I worked in employability, helping people with disabilities get into work. They would often, you know, maybe not go for a role if they're the only person who's going to be remote on the team, because then they feel like they're being excluded from the wider team and excluded from interaction. So it's really looking at, you know, your practices and, you know, how your team operates and then ensuring that it's inclusive and doesn't leave anyone out.
Yeah, absolutely. Rather than a tether, it's actually a celebration of being able to welcome people from different communities, isn't it? It all adds to the richness of organizations, really, being able to reach out to people that may not normally be able to access the roles themselves.
I think the move to more hybrid working and remote working is a great and excellent opportunity, I think, for people with disabilities, you know, people who might have physical disabilities, people who might suffer from chronic fatigue, and the idea of coming into the office every day was really challenging. And I just think it's a little bit disappointing that we haven't seen the numbers dramatically increase now that we've moved to more remote working over the last 4 years. You think that that should have really unlocked more and more people who have disabilities could work from home and get into the job market who might not be in the job market, creating more opportunities. And it's just a shame. I don't think we've really seen the numbers increase to the level that I think they should have done. You know, it should have moved much more towards a reflection of what the percentage of people within the society who have disabilities is. But sadly, we're not seeing that.
Well, that is actually one point that I was going to move on to, actually, is how we go about reaching people from these communities. And I know there's been quite a lot of work done by members of this panel and also the wider organization of Prospectus on reaching out to people from various communities. I had an example recently where I was contacted by the St. Giles Trust, who work with people with disabilities, people who've been affected by homelessness, but also people who have neurodiverse issues to deal with. And I think the access that those charities that we work with, the access that they give us to their service users, the people who work with the charities, can be very beneficial. So from our perspective, as part of the shortlisting process, we can offer specific brief interviews and preparation that we can give candidates advice on the best way to approach interviews, etc., because interview prep is part of the service that we provide here at Prospectus. So I think accessing the charities that we work with already to reach out to their networks of people for as potential candidates could be a good way of increasing the numbers of people with disabilities that we work with, and that will obviously buy in then to increasing the numbers that we can represent in our shortlists. I know Lauren's done some brilliant work on this with our internal recruitment. I wondered whether you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I do. So we've been, for over a year now, maybe even two, we've been advertising our internal roles at Prospectus on Scope, their website. Obviously, for people that aren't familiar with Scope, they help people with disabilities into employment. And it was something that I did from when I joined Prospectus, really, that I wanted to ensure that we were not necessarily prioritizing, but just ensuring that our internal vacancies were being promoted as far wide as possible. You can't always rely on people seeing your job ad on your website or on the jobs board. So actually, if you can go out to charities or support networks that support people with disabilities into employment, then why would you not do that? And that's something we've been doing now, as I mentioned, for a couple of years. And obviously, being part of the Disability Confidence Scheme, we guarantee interviews to people with disabilities as well. So that's something that I'm really proud of that we do at Prospectus and will continue to do.
And even build on that work, because the more we do it, the more it snowballs. And obviously, the more people with disabilities and neurodiversity that we can access. And that obviously then feeds into our shortlisting process. One of the final things I wanted to touch on is disclosure, how we advise candidates on disclosing their disability. In terms of our shortlisting process, we don't ask candidates about disabilities until they may require a reasonable adjustment to attend interview. Now, I think that has a lot of power when it comes to allowing candidates to make their own decision on disclosing right up until they're selected for interview. But I wonder whether some of us have been asked by candidates, do you think I should disclose? Or what would happen if I do disclose? Will I have prejudice shown against me? And then further from that, the kind of advice that we would offer. I know some of us have some thoughts on that.
My initial thought is that it begins with us as recruiters and providing that space to candidates, not just at the interview stage, but from the first time I've picked up a phone call to just tell them about the role and find out about themselves. I think it's something that's super important. Even if they don't disclose during that conversation, they may feel a bit more comfortable disclosing during the interview stage just because you've had that open means of communication. So I definitely think it's something that we need to be putting more at the forefront, or putting a bit more emphasis, or just showing exactly what we are able to do or how we're able to do it, just to accommodate around that person, support that person the best way that we can.
I have a feeling from my experience of talking to some people who have disclosed is that they were nervous of doing so, whether it be to us or whether it be to the employer themselves. But some of the advice that I give to candidates in that regard sometimes is that we are an intermediary. We are a middle person in the process, and they can disclose to us confidentially if they wish. And then we can work with them to help them make the decision as to if and when they want to disclose to the employer. We're legally encouraged to not disclose until the candidate has given us their permission.
Having done both sides, like being a recruiter and then also having done loads of job applications myself as a neurodiverse person, I think it can feel a huge catch-22 of whether or not to disclose. It can be, you know, if you're not 100% sure, then I would say do some more research into the organization you're applying for, and then see if it's somewhere that you actually want to work. You know, if there's a red flag about why don't I want to disclose, is there something that's sort of putting me off about it, then consider your application in the first place. I've had a candidate who was happy to disclose to me about their condition, but then was sort of saying, well, I don't want to disclose it to them just yet. So I was able to do the mitigating of any reasonable adjustments if they wanted them or if they needed them. And they didn't. And they did get the role that they went for, which was great. And I don't know whether they ended up disclosing it at all during their time there. But it can feel like a huge contradiction sometimes. And I think for us, if we're working with someone who and might have something to disclose, is having the patience, because it is their choice, but maybe there's a reason that they're not sure about it.
And I think we are in a very valuable position, really, isn't it, that we can offer that to candidates and guide them around disclosure. So us using our position as being a middle person can be very useful in freeing candidates up to disclose if they wish or not to, you know. So I think historically we use our position in that regard really well. And I think it's something as an organization we encourage our consultants to do more of, that advice and guidance aspect in the shortlisting process.
I think this disclosure point is a really interesting one. And I think quite important is because not everybody thinks the exact same way and everybody thinks differently. And I think going back to that disability confidence scheme we talked about earlier, some people don't want to disclose that they have a disability because they feel that they would like to be assessed on the merit of their application rather than be given an interview based upon a disability. And that's completely fine for them to think that. You know, I also think it's, you can disclose that you have a disability, but you don't have to disclose exactly what that is. You know, and I think that you can disclose you have a disability and make the employer aware that you have one. But I think it's a really important part, because they're talking about the terms and conditions of the role. If you have a disability or a neurodivergence and you need the role to flex a little bit around you in terms of how it's delivered, I think it shows you a little bit about what that employer is going to be like to work for. The recruitment process is a really good window into what it might be like to work for a prospective employer. And if they're welcoming, if they're open, if they're willing to have that conversation about how to make it work for you, then that should be giving you green flags and should be making you feel really confident about pursuing that application. I think that's the most important part about why I would recommend disclosure. And again, I understand people might be nervous about saying exactly what their disability or their neurodivergence is, because they feel that it could be negatively impacting their application down the line, you don't have to give the full details. You can just state that you have a disability and you require some reasonable adjustments. And when the time comes, you can disclose that for your interview or even at an offer stage. You've been offered the role, you feel that you might need to have a few things moved around a little bit to make it comfortable for you. That's a point in which you can give further details as well.
And that's a massive part of our work, representing clients to candidates and vice versa. So to candidates with disabilities or neurodiversity, we can support them by making sure that they feel free to disclose to us, and then we can guide them through their decision as to whether they'd like to disclose to the employer. I'm sure we'll all agree, really, that the vast majority of our clients at the moment are actively saying to us, please find us candidates from diverse backgrounds. Please find us candidates that are from as diverse a pool of candidates as possible so that we can have the best representation. And I get the impression that our clients are really authentic when they're saying that to us. So it is part of our job, really, to make sure that we are making those candidates feel as welcome and as free in their applications to us, and educated, really, as to their rights around disclosure and what they can say, what they want, when they want to, rather than being forced into any issues. So, brilliant. I think that is pretty much everything we wanted to cover at the moment. When it comes to increasing the representation for people with disabilities and from neurodiverse communities in our shortlisting, is there anything we haven't touched on that anybody in the panel thinks it may be important to mention?
I think part of the terms and conditions of the role is, and we talked a little bit about what it's like to work at an organization, is an openness about the whole package. You know, what are the benefits? What are the policies? I think people with disabilities might require additional time off. So having an oversight of what an organization's sickness policy is might be really helpful for someone to assess whether or not they'd be able to work for that organization. So you talked a little bit about hybrid working as well. So like oversight of all policies, oversight of what that might look like. We always have candidates asking us what the benefits are anyway, right? So I think those can be put on job descriptions, and you know, having oversight of what the company policies are could really help increase a lot of people applying.
Making sure the job descriptions and our adverts depict in a simple and clear manner how welcoming our organizations will be to people from diverse communities. And again, I think that's one of the dynamics that connects the threads of these series, is the culture being welcoming to people from diverse communities, but not just welcoming, actively welcoming, and making sure that candidates are aware of that at advertising, shortlist and interview processes.
Just to follow on from Matt's point as well, a lot of companies and businesses are also having accessibility statements as well. And I think that that's really important to have on your website as well, because that's something that people do look for, whether you have a disability or not, actually, just the accessibility of the role of the company. And also, we touched on it a little bit, I think, earlier, but when it comes to just having one way of being able to apply for a role, which is maybe online, thinking about other ways that people can apply for the role, maybe a video application, maybe a phone call of some kind, it just might open up more routes for people to be able to apply for a role that might not be able to complete it online for any, you know, a number of reasons. And also offering pre-application support as well. I think some people just want a phone call with you before they apply for the role to talk to you about the accessibility of it or their disability if they want to disclose at that point. So just having multiple ways for people to apply and having that openness from the very get-go, even before people apply, if they have questions about it, is just really important as well.
Yeah. If it, in the adverts it suggests an open and equitable process, then it needs to be backed up at every stage by offering different opportunities and different ways of applying for all roles. And that's our responsibility. And then we also can advise our clients on how to depict that in the copy of their adverts, and then also then reflect it back onto the website so that it works at every point of contact that a candidate could have during their application process. So as we draw to a close, we want to thank you very much for listening. We really hope that you found some of these points useful. We're very conscious that organizations will be at very different points in their EDI journey, of course, and solutions will differ for each organization. If you'd like to contact us directly, please do reach out to us via the prospectus website or LinkedIn, and our panel members will be really happy to help with any specific interest or questions that you may have. We look forward to hearing from you, and goodbye.